come ashore?
Yes, it did. It came right across, right down over top of us, right there.
There is the Hurricane Landfall Project truck. It's all set up, strapped down. We're going to turn all the switches on in just a little while. Standing outside of the Chevy Tahoe, we are getting into the eye wall of Hurricane Gene right now. Four came in on shore here along the southeast coast of Florida.
These little bullet cams right here that we will use to record that surge.
Hello again, I am Mark Suddeth, and this is Stories from the Hurricane Highway. We're up to episode 5 now of season 4, so glad you could tune in. We're going to continue our look back at the year 2010, and specifically the 2010 hurricane season. We're going to get into that, some of the seasonal outlooks that were issued ahead of time, how things turned out, and then we're going to go through some of the individual storms and hurricanes, and kind of stop short of the one hurricane that we went out for, and that was Hurricane Earl. And that's going to be covered in the next episode, because I'm going to have Jesse Bass. All right, yes, we're going to have Jesse Bass come on, and he and I are going to talk about that together because he helped me with Hurricane Earl out on the Outer Banks. So yeah, we'll talk about, so this will be kind of a short episode as we set everything up and get the stage all dressed, as they say, so that we can really get into especially Earl and then the overall season. We also had another big impact storm that was out over Bermuda, and that was Igor. And on that episode, I'm going to have my friend and colleague Tim Millar back, and we're going to talk about Igor. I didn't go to Bermuda, spoiler alert, but Tim did, and we'll talk about that also in an upcoming episode. So yeah, 2010, a very busy year for hurricanes. It was forecast to be as such. All kinds of different agencies were issuing forecasts for the hurricane season back then. There's even more now. In fact, Dr. Klotzbach has a website dedicated just to the different forecasting agencies, from private sector to academia and the occasional guy that just has a popular Facebook page. I don't know if there's that, but it almost seems that way now, right? So many people issuing forecasts. Different agencies is just a good general term for it. But back in 2010, just a quick rundown. You had TSR, that was Tropical Storm Risk, based out of the UK. Of course, Colorado State University. By the way, they started the whole thing back in the 80s, I believe it was. So there you go. TWC, the Weather Channel, and WSI, Weather Services International. NC State, right here in North Carolina, up in Raleigh, they were issuing forecasts. Dr. Lian Che, I interviewed and met with him long time ago, back in the mid-90s, early 90s, mid-90s, late 90s, somewhere in there. I was thinking I was going to go to NC State for meteorology, but I did not, as you know. But yeah, Dr. Lian Che, actually, he came down to UNC Wilmington and did a lecture, and I was just absolutely blown away by his intellect. And I went up to State to the Centennial Campus and met with him and some of his colleagues. I think it was in the late 90s, but anyway, I got sidetracked there. I saw NC State. Yeah, I'm reading some of this off Wikipedia, and I was thinking about that. Anyhow, yeah, so NC State was doing them as well. UK Met Office, the actual meteorological office out of the United Kingdom. AccuWeather was doing these back in 2010. Joe Bastardi associated with them as well. I think he was still with AccuWeather back in 2010. So there were a lot of agencies that were issuing forecasts. That's the point. And all of them were generally suggesting a very busy season. Even as far back, and we talked about this in a previous episode, but just to retrace our steps a little bit, as far back as December of 2009, it looked like it was going to be a fairly busy season. And that just increased the confidence and the forecasts by the time we got into April. And then, of course, by May and June, it really looked like it was going to be very busy. NOAA, on May 27th, issuing their forecast in a range, 14 to 23 named storms. Again, You're just never going to be wrong. Anyway, let's just move on. 8 to 14 hurricanes, 3 to 7 majors. As an example here, FSU, 17 named storms, 10 hurricanes, and they didn't issue any major hurricane forecasts. But June 2nd, Colorado State planted their flag and went with 18 named storms, 10 hurricanes, 5 major hurricanes, and they were forecasting an ACE score, the accumulated cyclone energy, of 185. Now, skipping ahead to the end of the book, as they say, how did it all end up? We're going to jump to the end, so to speak. And so it ended up that we had, actually 2010 was the first of 3 seasons in a row that had 19 named storms. That's crazy, isn't it? Well, we would repeat that pretty close anyway, almost 10 years later. But anyhow, yes, it was 2010, 2011, 2012. We ended up with just shy of 60 named storms total. Just insane. That's amazing. It really is. But yeah, we had 19 named storms. 12 of those became hurricanes. 5 became major hurricanes. Colorado State's forecast was really good. It was very well predicted. It was. The ACE score fell a little short at 165. Their June 2nd outlook was for 185. And we did. We had the La Nina came on. It was a very strong La Nina. The tropical Pacific really cooling off, and the hurricane season just went crazy. They were all over the Atlantic Basin, especially out in the open Atlantic. A lot of deep tropical activity that year, several Genesis points down in the tropics. Very, very symptomatic, if you will, of a warm tropical Atlantic, not a lot of dry mid-level air, and you know, things to sort of hold everything back. It just wasn't there. And stuff really cranked up, especially in late August. Now, it's interesting because, and again, just kind of jumping around the board here a little bit, the very first hurricane, storm and hurricane of 2010, and it looked like things were just going to get started like right out of the gate very, very quickly, was June 17th, and it formed in the Western Caribbean near Central America. That was Alex, and high pressure over the eastern United States, the Gulf of Mexico, etc., kept Alex buried in the Caribbean and then eventually the southwestern Gulf, and it made landfall south of Brownsville, Texas. It did move across Central America, and it became a hurricane. It was the season's first hurricane. It was over $1.5 billion of damage Alex caused. There were deaths, unfortunately, associated with Alex. And it was quite impactful. And again, it looked like it was really going to lead off the season as being extremely active. And then very close to the same area where Alex formed, just a few days later, I mean, not that much later, I guess, just a couple weeks, whatever. July 7th, another tropical wave that had migrated off Africa at the end of June, that came across and became a depression, and in the Gulf of Mexico, didn't make it to named storm status. Again, this is like June into July. Thought again, this is a big harbinger of what is coming. And then we had Bonnie that formed in the southeastern Bahamas. And that got cranking up in late July. And we thought, all right, this is the one that's going to bring that oil spill problem. Remember the BP, Deepwater Horizon? Yep, talked about it last episode. Bonnie, towards the latter part of July, really looked like it could be like the one that stirs all that up. No pun intended. Forming in the southeast Bahamas, not far from the Turks and Caicos. It just didn't have it, thank goodness. It didn't really come together much. It brought some inclement weather, tropical storm conditions, that kind of thing, across southern Florida. And it just basically went on almost like a 45-degree angle from southeast to northwest, cutting across the Bahamas, South Florida, eventually making landfall in southern Louisiana, southeast Louisiana area. Certainly causing some flooding, especially down in South Florida. But boy, it really cranked up the anxiety for people along the Gulf Coast. And it just looked like, you know, our worst fears were going to come to fruition. We had Alex, we had TD2, well removed from where the BP disaster was. Remember, that was just off the southeastern tip of Louisiana. And then Bonnie came along, and I just remember thinking this could be it. And we were watching it closely, myself, Watkins, and Jesse. We always call well, we have too many mics. Not too many, as in a bad thing. It's a good thing. So we call Watkins Watkins, and our friend Mike Cornelius, we just call him Cornelius. But anyway, Watkins lives in South Florida still. He did back then, and we were watching Bonnie closely and didn't pull the trigger, didn't go down there, you know, to South Florida. Really wasn't much of a need. And we were anticipating that maybe it was going to be a bigger deal than it was in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. But the conditions just didn't allow. There was just too much shear, and it just didn't have what it took. Thank goodness, you know, because we didn't need that. But it was interesting that it crossed right over the area where the oil problems were happening. You know, these big globs were still washing up on the beaches, and it was still very much a problem throughout the summer. A terrible, terrible year for the tourism industry down there, anywhere from Louisiana's beaches, Grand Isle, all the way over to Destin, the Emerald Coast of Florida, probably even over to Mexico Beach, the Forgotten Coast, as it's called. And it just, you know, between the oil slick and the potential of a very, wasn't a slick, it was a giant disaster, and the big hurricane season, it was just terrible, terrible, terrible for the Gulf Coast. So then we get into very early August, and we still didn't have anything really robust. You know, we had Alex in June, and then no hurricanes yet, you know, since, right? And we had Colin, and that was very early August, and, you know, it was out over the open Atlantic in the main development region, but it didn't do much. It was sheared, looked like a big mess out there, and it was like, I remember we started scratching our heads a little bit, like, okay, where are all these hurricanes? And boy, does that sound familiar, right? And they just weren't happening. It was these short-lived, you know, you had Bonnie, which didn't amount to much, and then Colin, not amounting to very much. And then we had TD number 5, and that was also in the early part of August, also in the Gulf of Mexico, milling around down there near the oil slick area. I keep calling it an oil slick. That's just such a misnomer. That's wrong. The disaster area. And so it was like, all right, we've had 5 cyclones. Remember, depressions are tropical cyclones. They're just not named yet. And one of them became a hurricane. No major hurricanes yet. And we're up to early to mid-August, right? And really nothing with any power and, you know, just... It just, we were starting to wonder, we really were. And like, okay, did somebody miss something? And even in 2010, with the early infancy of prolific social media, and certainly we still had, of course, Storm 2K and other message boards, people speculating like all the time, you know, where are all these hurricanes? Did somebody miss them? I mean, it was just like, it's funny how history repeats itself, because now, with the tools we've got all these years later, you can watch stuff every 5 minutes, it seems. But, yeah, I remember there was a lot of African dust that did come off in August, and that kind of put the kibosh on things. And it just seemed like maybe the season was not going to be quite as busy as was originally forecast. We'll be right back. Okay, so as we moved through the season, it looked like it had the potential to be very big. It started off fast and furious with Alex and then kind of sputtered down from there. We weren't really sure what was going on. But nevertheless, the anticipation was still there. The Atlantic was very warm. All the signals were still there. That didn't change. And, we did have a lot of African dust, and it was kind of dry out there for a period. We had a couple of short-lived storms, as I talked about in the first block here. But it still looked like it was full steam ahead eventually. You know, we still had late August and all of September and October to get through. And one of the really neat things that I did in 2010 was that I was invited by Dr. Rick Nabb. He was at the National Hurricane Center. He was offered the job, whatever you want to call it, with Brian Norcross. Brian Norcross was at the Weather Channel. That Nabb would be up doing the tropical updates, you know, hurricane specialist, whatever you want to call it. So you'd have Norcross and Nabb, a team there. And I don't remember exactly what year Dr. Nabb went to the Weather Channel. It might have been 2010. I can't remember off the top of my head. Maybe that's on Wikipedia, but I try to go with as much as I can with what I know instead of what I look up. But anyway, he was there in 2010, and he and I had known each other. I knew Brian Norcross a little bit, but he was such a big celebrity in the hurricane world that I wasn't like really good friends with him. I was more friends, I guess you could say, with Dr. Nabb. I knew him from the National Hurricane Center, from various conferences, and he was very aware of my work, you know, up through 2010. So he invited me, working with Weather Channel officials or whatever, management, to come up for their Hurricane Week. You guys remember that? I remember that. It was a week that they dedicated in August to the hurricane season with different shows, segments, specials, reports, whatever. Interviews, packages, all the different things they call it in media. And so he invited me to come up, and he said, you know, bring your stuff, your remote boxes, your wind tower, whatever. And I was like, wow, that's really good. He said, we'll have you up here, and we're going to do a whole morning and early afternoon out in the parking lot, and we're going to come to you. We'll do several interviews. We're going to talk about your equipment, your website. We'll show some of the video that you have captured over the years, the highlight, of course, being 2008 with Hurricanes Gustav and Ike especially. And it was a really big honor. Interestingly enough, and just little things to point out, just an observation, I had to cover those expenses. It was just, all right, you know, they invited me to come up, and I paid my way, gas, food, and hotel. I remember I stayed at a Hampton Inn not too far from the Weather Channel, and I went up the day before. I don't remember what day it was. I think it might have been like August 10th, 18th, 15th, I don't know, because we know that August 20th is typically regarded as the beginning of the Cape Verde season. So it could have been near August 20th, somewhere around there. Nevertheless, I went up there the day before, and I took my trailer and the equipment. I had a flatbed trailer at this point, and traded in the big old cargo trailer for a flatbed so we could haul everything more efficiently. And I went up the night before, day before, whatever, and I was supposed to be out at the studios at the Weather Channel in the parking lot, etc., at around 5 a.m. or so, 4:30 or 5, and I did that, and that's always hard to do. I'm going to tell you what, I'm just a night person. It's hard to get up early. So I went out there, and it was hot, sticky. Of course, Atlanta weather is like brutal in the summer. A couple of people took some digital pictures for me of myself and Dr. Nabb, and Jen Carfagno was out there. It was really exciting. You know, I did a few hits with them. We talked about the equipment. Dr. Nabb interviewed me. Mike Bettis was out there, the very famous and well-known Mike Bettis. Always did a good interview. Jen Carfagno, very popular at the Weather Channel. My friend Jim Cantore, of course, was there. I don't think I did any interactions. That's hard to say. I didn't have any interactions with Cantore on TV that I can recall. But whatever. It was a really fun day at the headquarters of the Weather Channel. You know, still no formal partnership in 2010. I was still more or less partnering with CNN, you know, but it was not a contract or anything. They were just, you know, CNN would help out. I was kind of a free agent, I guess you could say, you know, working with whomever, local media, CNN, and CNN, you know, would offer to, you know, cover expenses or whatever. But it was just nice, you know, hey, it's the Weather Channel. It was, you know, a big deal. It was nice to be on national TV and sort of showcase what we were doing, despite the fact that everything was big and bulky and nowhere near as cool as it is now. But, you know, that's what this is all about. You have to get to where we are now somehow. So, yes. And I do remember, though, a very vivid memory of being inside, thank goodness, the air-conditioned studio. I think it was that afternoon. And I was in there in Norcross. Brian was looking over some stuff. They have these giant monitors. You know, just amazing technology there. And I remember we were looking at things. I think I even sat in on an editorial meeting at some point as well. And we were looking at different things related to the tropics and what might be coming down the pike in the next few days to a week or so. And there just wasn't much. And, you know, we could all look at the models and see what might be coming later through the GFS out to 2 weeks. Storm 2K, internet sleuths would be looking at this stuff as well. And it just didn't look like there was a lot coming. There's a lot of dust, a couple of tropical waves, nothing looked like it really jumped out. And Norcross was even kind of scratching his head a little bit. You know, yeah, it is kind of dead out there. You're not sure when it's going to let up. But it should, you know, all the conditions are there for favorable activity to happen, right? Favoring it, that activity, and it'll come. That's what we all thought. But it was just interesting to sit there in the Weather Channel headquarters and watch this stuff on the these big monitors, these big plumes of dust coming off Africa, and it just looked like, well, we're getting towards late August. I don't think a lot's going to happen, you know. We'll see. You know, I'll believe it when I see it. Anyway, I wrapped it up and went back home. And that was it. You know, it was like, all right, we've had 5 tropical cyclones, as they say, right? I've already talked about this. Alex and Bonnie and Colin, 2 depressions that never developed into anything. We're up to late August now, getting into the third week, and not much is going on. So finally, I get back, and we're done with the Weather Channel thing, and we're into late August, and sort of right on cue, we get Hurricane Danielle. Okay, so like I said, I get back from the Weather Channel. It's, you know, again, it's that approaching the last third of August that I did that trip up to Atlanta. I come back, and it was right as, you know, like I said, that August 20th is like magic. It never fails. Dr. Bill Gray would always ding the bell that this is the beginning of the true part of the season. We've seen Klotzbach continue that tradition ever since Dr. Gray's death. Several years ago, that tradition of ringing the bell to usher in the true meat of the season in late August, you know, there's a reason for it. It really is. It's almost like a switch gets flipped, especially when the background state is favorable. It just, you know, some years everything's busy all the time. The whole thing starts early and it stays busy through November, December. Most of your busy years, it's just this perfect following of climatology. It ramps up really quickly at the end of August, peaks in mid-September, and then gradually, too sharply sometimes, comes down. And that's what happened in 2010. And so that happened at the last third of August. There's like the 21st or so. You had a tropical wave, the intertropical convergent zone, all that energy out there, the very warm Atlantic tropical waters, whatever, gave birth to Hurricane Danielle. Now, Danielle stayed out over the open Atlantic. There was just too much troughing off the east coast of the United States. We would obviously come to learn that over the coming weeks and months of 2010, but we didn't know then. You know, everyone that formed out there, oh, could this come all the way across? You know how it works. The vigil begins. Danielle never really looked like it had much of a chance to make it all the way across. Maybe threatening Bermuda at some point, but even that didn't look too likely. It was more likely that it would stay east of Bermuda. So anyway, Danielle started out in the deep tropical Atlantic, and it quickly organized, moving off to the west, to west-northwest, and it became a hurricane on the 23rd of August, so just a couple of days on in its lifespan, it became a hurricane. And it was a minimal hurricane for just a few days. It, too much wind shear out there, that kind of thing. But as we got towards late August, the atmosphere changed, and it just rapidly intensified, becoming a Cat 4, the first of five major hurricanes that year. And it peaked at 130 miles per hour, going around the western side of the big old Azores High. The Bermuda High wasn't as prevalent, you know, the Bermuda-Azores High, when they couple up. You can get these things to go all the way across, but that wasn't the case for Danielle. It rounded the periphery of the Azores High out there in the eastern Atlantic, and it stayed east of Bermuda. Bermuda did get under a tropical storm watch briefly, but it was canceled very quickly. That was around the 27th of August, because Danielle would be well east of the island. But these big, powerful hurricanes, they do generate swells. I'll talk about that today. Hopefully I talked about that back then. Ocean swells, impacts are impacts, no matter what they are. If the hurricane causes a reaction, you know, in the atmosphere, the ocean, whatever, that's an impact. And swells from Danielle reached the east coast of the U.S. and, you know, of course, Bermuda as well. And there were like hundreds of rescues because of this, from Maryland down to Florida, the Carolinas. And it does look like, again, reading off Wikipedia here, that there was probably one death associated, because it did find a body, unfortunately, in the waters off of Satellite Beach, Florida. Another man went missing off of Ocean City. That body was never recovered. So it was a really, really big deal. And in 2010 also, again, off Wikipedia, you got to love it. Most of the time, it's accurate, especially the scientific stuff. For celebrities, not so much. Anyway, an interesting tidbit about Danielle. Researchers examining the Titanic wreckage had to bail out and head over to St. John's, Newfoundland, and swells of 10 meters. I'm sorry, 10 meters. Whew! That'd be pretty big, wouldn't it? 3 meters, or just about 10 feet, that's a little bit more tolerable, 3 meters impacted the coast of Newfoundland. So Danielle really was this, you know, example of a hurricane literally out over the central Atlantic, passing between, I guess, 50 and 60 degrees west longitude, something like that. But it was powerful enough, and it lived long enough, if you will, and that's a big key here, that engine just puts the energy into the ocean, that yes, it did have impacts along the eastern United States, likely causing the deaths of at least two people, disrupting the research there, as I mentioned, of the Titanic, etc. And it really did begin this streak that would go on for weeks on end, and I'm going to wrap up this episode just kind of glancing over it, and then we're going to pick up on the next episode specifically about Earl. So we had Danielle, and then we went on to have Hurricane Earl, and then we had Tropical Storm Fiona, and then we had Tropical Storm Gaston, Tropical Storm Hermine, Hurricane Igor. Again, that'll have its own episode when we have Tim Millar come on. Hurricane Julia, Hurricane Carl, Hurricane Lisa, Tropical Storm Matthew, down in the Caribbean. And then we had Tropical Storm Nicole. And then we kept on going. Otto, that was late September. Paula, Richard, Sherry, I think that's how you say it, or Shari, Sherry, whatever, S-H-A-R-Y. Tomas, and that's where we ended up. Tomas, and that was in October, very late October. So yeah, it was a quite busy season. Alex leading it off. We ended up with Tomas in late October. Danielle, the first of the fairly significant impacts. I mean, you know, when you lose two lives, you have all those swells, all those rescues, beach erosion. You know, you don't have to have landfalls. Danielle far enough offshore to spare a direct hit, of course, but still having impacts. But the next episode, we'll get into Earl. Earl would send me to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. That would be the closest that we would get to a hurricane for the East Coast, or anywhere in the United States for that matter. And we'll talk about that in the next episode of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. And again, I'll have Jesse Bass join me for all of that. All right. As always, I do appreciate your time and attention, your feedback. I love it. I appreciate it. It motivates me. It keeps me going to produce these. I like doing it. It's really neat to be able to tell you these stories as we go back and we look through history and we, you know, we pick up a few tidbits, like the old thing about the Titanic there. Along the way, I remember things that I might have otherwise forgotten. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. Again, thank you so much for tuning in. I do appreciate it. I am Mark Suddeth, Hurricane Track. That's us. That's you. I'm glad you're a part of it. I'll be back with another episode for you next week.